rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Dan Gaynor is with us. He's with the Free Market Project, freemarketproject.org. He's the director of the Business and Media Institute. Hey, Dan.
How are you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm actually doing pretty well. I even have a voice despite having watched football yesterday.
Oh, I'm glad you survived the experience. Dan, you are, the Business and Media Institute has put out this article by Julia Seymour, Electronic Voting, the Catastrophe That Wasn't. And you note, after the election, the media is silent on left-wing claims of a Diebold Bush conspiracy. Give us the snapshot of this.
Well, the snapshot, ever since 2004, we've been hearing about Diebold, about black box voting. I think you've actually written some pieces involving Bev Harris. She's written a book. There was a documentary. We heard a lot about it. Going up to the election, we heard Lou Dobbs talking about it, Katie Couric talking about it. And I'm not making any argument one way or the other on whether there's a problem with the voting. But what we do hear is there's this conspiracy. Oh, my God, it's going to happen. And then when the election comes, and either the media are happy with the result or they're just not willing to talk about the conspiracy anymore, it's gone away like magic.
Yeah, I agree. The media is treating this like it's a non-existent issue. And in fact, there are tens of thousands of reports, primarily from Florida, Illinois, Texas. I just have AP story after AP. I'm talking about the Associated Press stories. Trenton, New Jersey. I mean, there were Republicans concerned about it in New Jersey, claiming that votes were being flipped. In Sarasota, Florida, you have 18,000 people who voted and their vote didn't get recorded in the most Democratic county of the four counties that were in Catherine Harris's area, causing the Republican to win by, 300 and some odd votes, fewer than 400 votes. Over and over and over again, these reports are coming in, and yet the media is completely ignoring them. Are you suggesting that, as I am, that this is the media is falling down at the switch, or are you suggesting that, there's no problem here?
Well, no, I have no idea where there's no problem. I'm not an electronic voting expert. I'm not going to pretend. I am a media guy. Mm-hmm. And, yes, I would say the media overhyped or underhyping. Take your pick. Either one, they've done something badly.
Yeah.
And I would certainly say the whole claim of conspiracy that they emphasize so much, you either believe there's a conspiracy, in which case, day after election, you should be out saying, well, there either appears to have been none or there is one. And, just where's the follow-up? Where's anybody calling them and say, hey, guys? I mean, Lou Dobbs, they actually talked about a left-wing conspiracy, too. They talked about Venezuela having some influence in some of the voting machines. And then they don't talk about it either. So I think it's a horrendous follow-through. And I do think there's a lot of hype in the media these days. There's been problems with every vote I think mankind has ever taken. Once you add more than a couple people, any of the technology that we've had, there's always people who either try to seek to subvert it or there's just problems with it. So, how many people remember the hanging Chad problem,
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have electronics for that.
Well, that was a convenient focus for a very, very tight race and not getting into the whole issue of the recount. But I agree with you, oddly enough. I mean, usually we debate these things, although there's a larger issue here that I think that we should be talking about. But here's my take on it. The Democratic Party, and I think this was insane, I'm sure this was not Howard Dean's decision, because he's the only politician who's ever actually hacked a Diebold machine on live TV. He did it on Topic A with Tina Brown as a way of pointing out the problem. But the Democratic Party's position and what they were saying basically to all of us in the media was, don't talk about electronic voting machines and about vote theft, about vote fraud, because it'll cause people to say, well, why should I even bother showing up at the polls? My vote won't get counted anyway. And the consequence of that will be that people won't show up at the polls and we'll lose elections. And I disagreed with them. I thought that talking about it would get people so pissed off that they would show up at the polls. It would get people really angry and really upset. But, that's a debate that's still ongoing. But there's a larger issue here, Dan Gaynor, and this is where I'm guessing that you and I are on opposite sides of this. I think it's insane that we privatize our vote. The vote is the most vital part, in my opinion, of the entire commons. I mean, it is the part of the commons by which we determine how the rest of the commons is handled and managed. And I'm assuming that you have no problem with the vote having been privatized.
We've always had voting machines that were built by somebody. I mean, they have to be built by somebody.
Our typewriters, but that's the old mechanical voting machines had no software. You could open the panel on the back and turn the dials and set all the numbers to zero, all the counters to zero, and that was it. I mean, you could see how they worked.
This is
a very different thing. These machines tell us, we push the button and they tell us what we did and they tell us how we voted after the fact, and they do it in secret.
Well, I think anybody who has concern, I mean, those kind of concerns, I think can be addressed, and probably fairly simply. I mean, look, when I go to the store and buy a pack of gum, I get a receipt, and the store gets a receipt. And, I don't see why, and you can get a tape receipt. I don't see why that could not be done. And I think that would go a long way.
Because a receipt would be a placebo. It'd make people think that their vote had been correctly recorded.
But have a hard copy both directions.
Yeah, who's going to count the hard copies?
I'd rather have at least the hard copy than have nothing at all. Have no
evidence. Then let's have, at the very most, let's have computers that look like touchscreen voting machines, but in fact are ballot printers. And you go through the process on the screen, and it spits out a ballot, and that ballot gets counted, and that ballot can be inspected by the voter to make sure that it's actually filled out correctly, and the software that's running on the voting machine is completely transparent and available to anybody to see how it works. But it's not the machines counting the vote; it's people.
I'm not real dogmatic on it. I really am not. I mean, I think it's important, and this is where you're probably surprised I'm not really disagreeing with you a lot on this. Is that I think it's important for everybody, left and right, to feel like their vote is counted. So,
yeah.
I mean, if we can, there's got to be a way of sorting this out. And I would like to see it done now, but you won't see it done now because it's still a political tool. I mean, it's one of the big parade of crazy conspiracy theories. I think that's a little nutty. I'm not saying there's not technical problems or something like that. But, poor Diebold gets raked over the coals. I think they were involved in creating the ATM, too. And, we all trust those.
But their ATMs are not hooked up to the internet. Their ATMs, I don't have the ability to walk up to an ATM and in about 10 seconds with a small screwdriver pop open a panel and slip in a PCM CIA card and completely reprogram the ATM. I can do that with a voting machine.
In 10 seconds?
Yeah. Yeah, it's about how long it takes to unscrew a screw, yeah.
I would like to see that. But
go to YouTube.
Yeah.
YouTube.com and check it out. I mean, there's a whole how-to on there.
But again, like I said, I'm not really fighting that battle. I mean, I think media has been very kind of crazy on this whole issue, and unfortunately, given another few months,
Why don't we unite then, Dan? Because you believe in free market issues, and so do I. I mean, we're both in favor of capitalism to a certain extent. I'd like it more regulated than you would. I think that's probably the main divisor between us, to the extent that you consider yourself right and I consider myself left, but. Apparently you agree with me that there is a role for government in protecting the commons. There are things that should be done outside of the for-profit system, and certainly handling the vote is one of them. Are we in agreement on that?
Yeah, I think government should definitely be involved in handling votes.
Okay. Then,
I have no problem with that.
Then how do we convince Republicans and Democrats, Greens and Libertarians, right across the board, how do we convince America that having proprietary software and for-profit voting machines, having companies whose first goal is not to deliver a vote, but whose first goal is to make a profit, and thus they may be more likely to engage in fraud. How do we convince people that having these companies in the process is wrong?
Well, I don't necessarily convince them that having them in the process is wrong. I think it has to be removed, that you have to remove the whole issue from the political process. I mean, and right now, up to now, it's been used as a club for one side against another. And, you have to remove it from that. You have to say, let's just look at the whole issue. Stop thinking about it as a political issue and look at it as an issue. Let's try to deal with it in an off year when it's not elections, and say, let's set up some standards. What are the standards nationwide? watch.
Well, this is the thing. As long as there's for-profit corporations and as long as we've allowed them to privatize our vote, they're saying, oh, we've got the standards. We've got everything. Just trust us.
But we have
and then 18,000 votes go missing in Florida.
I mean, it's, well, like I said, we had missing votes without the electronic, too. We do have getting some sort of universal action. Now is the time to do it. If you wait until the election's closed, then it becomes a political football game.
I agree with you. And frankly, I think we should just go back to paper. But Dan Gaynor, director of the Business and Media Institute, freemarketproject.org. Dan, good talking to you.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks for being on the program. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix.
Found a better way of making it seem clean. We built an electronic voting machine, and then we sold these suckers nationwide. But we're the only ones who know what's on the inside.
You push the button. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Yeah, let's play that out a little bit here.
The billionaires don't want you to vote this year. We'll send you a message that's loud and clear that the votes can't be counted in your community. Why even register? Don't waste your energy. Don't go to the polls on election day, because we bought the election and it better go our way. And on election night, we'll sit back and glow. The billionaires don't want you to vote.
Yeah, the billionaires, they don't want you to vote. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. We're working on getting Clint Curtis on the line here as well. I'm not sure what's going on, but we will hopefully get to him in just a moment. But this is just this whole issue of electronic voting. In my mind, the bottom line here is that the commons are being raped, essentially, by these big corporations. Diebold qualifies, I guess, as a big corporation. We should not be handing our vote off to anybody. The vote is the principal franchise by which democracy is achieved. And back in the old days, I think 64 was the first election when we had mechanical voting machines. The government, the state and county governments, local governments actually bought those machines. They owned those machines. And they could see the little wheels in the back and all that kind of thing. It was not a matter of, hey, trust us, we're the software company. Clint Curtis is on the line with us. He ran for Congress in Florida's 4th district against Tom Feeney, a guy who, in years previous, according to Clint, had hired Clint to write software that would hack voting machines and flip elections. ClintCurtis.com is website. Hey, Clint, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you for having me, sir.
You are contesting the election.
Well, we are investigating contesting the election. Right now we're having a lot of trouble getting the data to actually look at.
You have not yet conceded, then?
No.
I'm assuming Tom Feeney has declared victory, though.
Well, he actually declared victory before the election, but then he would know, wouldn't he?
So what's the basis for contesting the election? Are you using this as an opportunity to try to find out what's going on inside the machines, or was the election? I'm sorry, I don't have the stats on your election. Was it close enough that you think that there's actually a possibility that you actually did win?
Well, with the electronic machines, close doesn't matter anymore because you can flip it to anything you want. We did a pre-election poll, actually Zogby did, showed us dead even. We had a system where people could vote for us online and register to vote. 35,000 roughly people did, showing that, we were actually ahead by about 2 or 3, maybe even 4 points. And then we did an election poll at the end, which showed we were either ahead by 2 or down by 2. So it was a pretty close election.
Right.
But in the actual results, we lost by 20 points.
Whoa!
As did every other Democrat in Florida.
You're kidding. Every Democrat in Florida lost by 20 points?
Everybody was down 60-40, which is even odder because all of the national polls showed that 60% of the people were coming out to vote for Democrats and voting out Bush. Kind of a Bush protest vote. So in Florida, it's actually the opposite.
So is it possible, Clint Curtis, that the entire Florida vote was flipped?
It's very possible. In fact, we had a meeting this Saturday with a lot of candidates, a dozen or so, and we're all collecting information, and we're going to look it over, and we will have a way to actually tie the voter to the vote and find out. At least we will know.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing, amazing. Is it in Sarasota where there's 18,000 missing votes? I've lost my my sheet here. Here we go. Yeah, Sarasota, Florida, 18,000 votes missing. This is Christine Jennings' race against Vern Buchanan. This for Catherine Harris's old seat in the Florida 13th. You ran in the Florida 24th. Why is the media not covering this, number one? And number two, as a Democratic candidate, did you hear the same message that I heard from, now I didn't hear this from the DNC itself, but I had several Democratic members of Congress say to me explicitly, off air, please don't talk about voting fraud. We're afraid it's going to cause people not to show up at the polls. And I said, you know, respectfully, Congressman, I'm not going to take your advice.
Right.
Were you getting that same advice from the Democratic Party?
I heard that all the time. It's almost like they're afraid it will cut their funding if they mention the fact that they may not have a fair shake.
Yeah.
And in reality, why would you continue to lose elections if you don't have a fair shake? Fix the problem. That's what people expect out of you, is that little bit of honesty to tell them that you know they may not have a fair shake, but you're going to do something about it.
Right. We need to get the Democratic Party on this thing. we need to get the Democratic Party going on it. You know, wake up, guys! And the Republican Party as well, frankly. I understand there's at least one place in the United States where the Republicans are claiming that somebody hacked machines.
Well, it's good. I mean, they should be very worried now, because with the Democrats in power and not talking about any sort of a vote fraud issue, you would wonder, well, maybe are they planning on taking control of the machines now?
Yeah.
If I were the Republicans, I'd be just as frightened.
Yeah.
Lack of transparency goes both ways.
Very, very interesting. Clint Curtis, ClintCurtis.com, the website. Clint, good luck.
Thank you, sir.
Keep us up to date on how it's going.
I will do.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Yeah, give us a shout or send us an email anytime anything changes and let us know, because we want to stay on top of this issue and on top of this story generally. We'll be taking your calls right after this, 866-440-8466, our phone number, 27 minutes past the hour.
Where did my ballot go? Wanna know where my ballot went? They lost my vote. I made my choice. Does anybody care to hear my voice? They lost my vote. Was that the plan? Nobody, 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 nobody knows that I took a stand.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy in America. David in West Palm Beach, Florida. We got several calls from Florida here saying that Clint Curtis was not quite right about the vote ratio. Hey, David.
Tom.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hey, Tom, first I just want to say by far you're the best on the radio.
Well, thank you, David.
And your comment, tag your rate, is what made me run in 04. I ran for state house, and, you know, the demographics weren't as were pretty close compared to what the result was, 60-40, and I lost. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that almost every Democrat in that area lost 60-40 when they were running against an incumbent.
Really?
And I found it extremely, you know, odd, except I did have the resources to fight it. My opponent spent $300,000. I spent $9,000. You know, I mean, there's a huge difference in money when it comes.
Wow.
It's hard to raise money when you're running against a guy with $300,000 for a state house office.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. I think that your guest is right. It's just amazing that these numbers are almost across the board the same, and we're not doing anything about it.
Yeah.
I still can't understand how Charlie Crist won when there's more registered Democrats in Florida than Republicans, and the Democrats showed up this time.
Right. Yeah.
How do you win?
I can't tell you. I mean, the bottom line is, without a paper trail, without people having filled out ballots. I mean, worst case scenario, like here in Oregon, for example, we have vote by mail. Every single
right.
vote is done. Yeah, I mean, people do it at home, right? Fill it out and mail it in. They get counted on ES&S machines, which makes us all crazy. But
right. But
we have a very, very good and honest Secretary of State, a guy by the name of Bill Bradbury here, who's just, you know, as honest as the day is long. And they test these machines 16 ways to Sunday. And he has a lawsuit right now against ES&S, you know, going on. But still, I mean, you know, we at least have a paper trail down in Florida. You got a lot of folks who voted. There's no paper trail.
There's no paper trail. There's nothing. I mean, I could go to an ATM machine and get out $500. It'll show me exactly what's left in my account. Why can't we do it with our votes?
And
you know, I mean, why can't we do what Oregon's doing? If it seems to be working, you know what? I tell you, something will be done because the Republicans lost this time.
Yeah,
so
I think you're right.
Within the next 2 years, they're going to be screaming about, you know, now we're going to start counting the votes correctly.
I think you're right. It's going to be the Dino Rossi scenario. David, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for running for office. Good on you.
Tom, you're great. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, David. Kenny in West Palm Beach, another Florida listener here. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, hi, Tom. The statement was a little bit exaggerated, saying that every Democrat lost 60-40. I mean, Tim Mahoney beat Joe Negron / Mark Foley. Ron Klein beat Clay Shore. If there had been a flip in election, you would certainly think that they would target those two, especially Clay Shore.
Well, and then you've got this election in Sarasota County where 18,000 votes
biggest,
are missing.
Right.
But if those 18,000 votes were added in, it probably would be 60-40 in favor of the Republican.
But they're also saying on that vote in Sarasota was another butterfly ballot because they had the two candidates for the for that office were above the governor and separated and on the same page when they could have just had them on their own page.
But it was electronic.
So why, you don't have to pay for an extra page of paper. Why not just have a different page for every election?
Yeah.
And which you know, by hook or by crook, that would be the argument. I don't know. I'm having a hard time.
But why is it just in one county? I mean, there's four counties in that district.
In three of those counties,
everybody voted for House of Representatives. In one of those counties, the most heavily Democratic of those counties, nobody voted for House of Representatives. Why?
Exactly. Well, no, I'm not arguing that. I'm saying that that's more of a fix than just going in and flipping the vote so that every Republican won 60-40.
Yeah. No. In other words, you do structural fixes rather than hack fixes.
Right. If it was a paper, they might have picked it up when they were checking it, but they didn't. But they didn't pick it up on the summary and all that kind of stuff, so who knows. But I'm just saying it doesn't help to exaggerate things.
Yeah.
The State House Democrats picked up 5 seats in Florida, which is significant because that means that now the Republicans can't just pass anything they want because the minority was so low they couldn't even argue.
Right. So here's the question, Kenny. Let's assume for a moment, it may not be a good assumption, but let's just assume the worst. And let's assume that there actually was vote hacking and vote rigging going on, and that the people doing it decided to let the Democrats win by a small margin in some areas and gave a few Democratic victories. Is this bone that got thrown to the dog going to be enough to shut up the Democratic Party about the election, about voting machines?
You mean to keep the Democratic Party from not wanting to get voting machines fixed?
That's right.
Getting them corrected so that there's
a trail? That's right.
I don't know. I hope not. Yeah. I hope they argue.
Are you hearing anything from Democrats in Florida? I mean, you live there. You're in West Palm Beach. Are you hearing outrage from Democrats about these electronic machines?
No, but then...
Yeah, see, there you go.
Actually, but in all fairness, we're all a little bit on vacation now. You know, it's a little bit towards the end of the year. When January comes around and everybody's back in session, that's when, you know, hopefully all this stuff will be taken back.
It'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. Kenny, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Ken in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Oh, good morning, Tom. You know, I really enjoyed listening to Clint. We had him here, speak here in Nashville. We have a group called The Gathering that's very concerned. Bernie Ellis runs it.
Mm-hmm.
Very concerned with the vote. As far as the first guest goes, I'm really bothered when somebody comes on and practically every sentence is filled with conspiracy theorist, conspiracy theory. First off, name calling does not a discussion make. Second off, I don't know about you. I've been an activist on the issue, and you have.
I've been writing about this issue for 4 years. I wrote the first article outing Chuck Hagel as the guy who is the president of ES&S.
But you, neither you or I sit around and say, hey, there's a gigantic conspiracy here. No, we want these counted fairly and honestly, and for them to be accountable.
Well, I'll tell you, I think there may be a giant conspiracy here.
I really do. There may be.
And, you know, give me a tinfoil hat. I'll put it on. I mean, there is something going on here.
Yeah.
And frankly, just the fact that any person in America may be sitting around saying to themselves, maybe there's a conspiracy, should be enough to say, hey, we should not have a system that is sufficiently hackable that it will generate people being worried about conspiracies.
And I will tell you, Tom, one of the proudest moments, and I know this is reverse psychology according to most people, one of the proudest moments was during the 2000 election for me when we saw Democrats and Republicans sitting together and honestly trying to assess what the voter wanted. And to me, that was wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's what we need. I'm not in a rush to find out who wins.
Yeah, like in 2000, you mean when they were counting the votes down in Florida?
Yeah.
And then of course, John Bolton, our UN ambassador, went down there with a whole contingent of people from Tom DeLay's office and started banging on the windows and claiming to the press that they were local Floridians, and thus began the end of it. Ken, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. Good point. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Just four quick points here. First of all, your first guess where you're talking about the receipts being illegal.
Yeah.
Receipts are illegal for voting because of the private vote.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Secondly, a thing everybody should consider, ask yourself a question. Why can Diebold make ATMs that are essentially accurate and the same company makes voting machines that sometimes have double-digit error rates? Then consider that one of the main programmers of Diebold had 23 felony counts of fraud for putting back doors into ATM software, so he could get in there.
Well, apparently then they weren't making ATMs that were quite as secure as we think. I mean, there might be a huge, dirty little secret here that the ATM industry has, the banking industry has, that they've just managed to not let slip into the mainstream press.
Yeah. And then, it's not a thing about conspiracy theories. Like, I'm an anomalies expert, an anomalies investigator. You know, Sequoia, every company has strange anomalies. And what happened right now, Denver, 10% of the people didn't get to vote, apparently,
right,
because of Sequoia problems. It also happened in Monterey, California.
Yeah.
And so the thing about the conspiracy thing, it doesn't, with voting, you don't have to have a big conspiracy with electronic voting. You need one person. With paper ballots, look how many people it would take to stuff ballot boxes.
You're right. If you wanted to stuff 100,000 ballot boxes in America, you'd have to have 100,000 people. If you want to hack 100,000 machines and they're on a network, you can do it with one person.
One mildly competent programmer.
Right, yeah, one mildly competent 15-year-old. I mean, this is not rocket science. We're talking computer programming here. Oh, my. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. David in Eureka, California. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom, I know that Brad Friedman said that in Florida they've made it illegal to be able to recount absentee ballots. But that's
Yeah, same thing in Nebraska.
Yes, but that is
Chuck Hagel's state.
Well, they shouldn't live with that. Now, here in Humboldt County, we've been granted the right to recount 10% of our absentee ballots, and I understand we need some volunteers here at the registrar's office to help, but Florida,
right,
Nebraska should not live with that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's a violation of democracy. In fact, there are, in Ohio, you have to have a certain threshold. There's maximums and minimums and all this kind of, it should be that if anybody thinks there's something wrong with the vote, they should be able to come down and examine it, in their own time, at their own expense.
It's the cons overly confident saying, we are going to steal the election and you're going to have to live with it. We're not going to let you do anything about it. That's what we're hearing.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you, David, and it's wrong. It's just absolutely wrong. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening on KGOE there in Eureka as well. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Here in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy, my friends. Take no imitations. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back. Back 9.5 minutes before the hour, exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bonnie in Burgistown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, regarding your first guest, I have a couple of points I'd like to make. He seemed to imply that the media are happy about the election results. And I don't think they're any more happy about the current election results than they were with the 1994 election results.
Well, they're completely spinning it. I mean, it's just amazing to watch the spin that's coming out of this. The media.
I was going to say the same thing.
You know, there's this coalition of the right wing Democrats, the DLC, the Rahm Emanuels and the Chuck Schumers on the one hand, who are trying to say, oh, this was a triumph of moderates and conservatives. Don't pay attention to those liberals who got elected out there and those progressives, and the media saying, oh, this is because the Democrats went to the right. And in fact, the Democrats who won and won big were the Democrats who went to the left, who went populist.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. I think it's a mixed bag, depending on, you know, which area you're talking about. But they have to make it very simplistic. And their explanations, they have these dramatic backstories, and they give it with zest and confidence.
Yeah.
And for what
reason? Well, and the other big problem is that there are no progressives who interviewed in the media. I mean, they want to get a Democratic spokesperson on, so they get on Donna Brazil or they get on James Carville, you know, whose wife is the Republican strategist for Dick Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, give you a break.
Yeah,
and Paul Begala, you know, these old DLC guys, or they get on Al Sharpton, who, you know, Al's a decent guy, but you know, he's got some baggage, shall we say.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, rather than having on, I mean, why don't they get on Amy Goodman? Why don't they get on Russ
Cohen.
Feingold? Yeah, exactly. Jeff Cohen. I mean, there are some really articulate progressive people out there.
Definitely.
Who could be regular talking heads on TV. Jeff Cohen probably would be one of the very best, in fact. You know, he was the producer of The Donahue Show, and he founded Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You got his right-wing counterpart, Cliff Kincaid, on all the time.
Oh,
you know,
definitely.
He's like everywhere. So it's just, you know, it's just absolutely wrong. Bonnie, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. Gus in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Gus, what's up?
All right, Tom. It's an honor to speak with you. First time I've talked to you. I've talked to a lot of other hosts. What I'd like to say is probably a little bit off the beaten path for you, but I kind of have to take you to task for something you said during a Thursday interview. I don't know, or it was a caller. I don't know if you have it up on your screen, but the caller asked you if you had seen Freedom to Fascism, and you remarked that you had seen it and that you had interviewed Aaron a couple times.
No, what I said was I'd seen the trailer and I didn't.
Oh, okay, that's right.
Uh-huh. And that I wanted to see the movie. And Saturday, day before yesterday, I saw the movie.
Oh, okay.
And so my opinion now I can give you a real opinion, because at the time what I had was a pseudo opinion.
Okay.
And my real opinion is that the first half of the movie is an unnecessary tangent. May or may not be true, but it's an unnecessary tangent. Second half of the movie is brilliant.
Okay. So now the point I was going to make is that notwithstanding this, your last comment, is that you kind of made a statement that Aaron made, I think your words were a technical argument or a technical analysis, somewhat like your technical analysis that you had in...
Right, about Santa Clara.
Unequal protection.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, as an aside, I'm a member of a Unitarian Universalist church, and we formed a in-corporate personhood committee based largely on that work. It was very inspiring. It was a piece of work that I was not aware of. But getting back to it, I thought your statement that reduced both his argument, which was structurally pretty much like yours, and your argument, it diminished both of them, really, because basically you said that, well, on the theoretical level, he might have a point, but on the practical level. I mean,
yeah, and that's the problem with both. Corporate personhood needs to be addressed by either a new Supreme Court decision or specific legislation.
You want to get rid of
the Fed, or you want to get the 16th Amendment unratified or re-ratified or whatever, and or you want to get the income tax done away with. You're going to have to do that either through the Supreme Court or through legislation. Just saying it isn't enough.
I think it's fine
that Aaron Russo is raising the issue, but if you do away with the income tax in the United States, how are you going to fund government?
Okay, here's the thing: is that the income tax basically was brought about to pay for World War One.
No, it wasn't. It started in 1913. World War One didn't start until 1917.
They had that in the hopper. They were arming, But my point is...
No, the income tax came out of the progressive movement of the late 1890s. It came out of Teddy Roosevelt's efforts in the early 1900s as a way of knocking down the robber barons. That's what the progressive income tax was all about. And Franklin Roosevelt raised it up to a 90% top rate and accomplished that, by the way. We didn't have an era of robber barons from 1935 to 1980. The robber barons only returned after Ronald Reagan did away with the top end of the income tax. The income tax, a progressive income tax, is the great leveler in our society.
Okay, I would respectfully disagree with that. But anyway, I think that in large part the income tax or the funds that are acquired through that enable the military-industrial complex to continue these...
It's a completely separate issue, though, Gus. I mean, it's a completely separate issue. I agree with you that we have a problem with the military-industrial complex. I'm the first to say that. But there, you know, if you do away with the income tax, it will be replaced by some other tax. We'll go to a value-added tax like they do in Europe, for example, where every step along the way, you know, goods and services are taxed.
And you've been in advocating tariffs, which is what paid for the government up to the point of the income tax.
Well, yeah, to a large extent. And I think that we should go back to tariffs. But it's nonetheless... Each of these need to be dealt with as separate issues. They really do. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in Little Beirut, as George Herbert Walker Bush called Portland, Oregon. Welcome back to our program. You know, there is risk inherent in pretty much everything, but certainly a disproportionate amount of risk, I suppose, inherent in being a member of civil society, in working, in being basically vulnerable to the system as a whole, once a system is created. And what we are seeing now across America is a huge transfer of that risk from the social institutions that have traditionally held it, the government, Social Security, things like that, and employers, to us, to you and me. One of the most articulate and eloquent spokesmen on this topic, Jacob Hacker, a professor of political science at Yale University, a fellow at the New America Foundation, the author of The Divided Welfare State, The Road to Nowhere, most recently the co-author of Off Center, The Republican Revolution, and The Erosion of American Democracy. He has a new book out. It's called The Great Risk Shift. The subtitle is Assault on American Jobs, Families, Healthcare, and Retirement, and How You Can Fight Back. Jacob Hacker, and we just in the last segment we were talking about hacking voting machines. No relation to the two.
No, not at all, although I find that when people can't figure out what my last name is, I just say, think computer hacker.
There you go. Just think voting machine. Yeah, so. And you'll never forget your name.
Thanks for having me on.
Jacob, glad to have you with us here. Tell us about the Great Risk Shift. How and when did this begin? Well, first of all, let's define terms.
Sure. The Great Risk Shift is really the story of how in almost every aspect of our economic life, our jobs, our health care, our retirement, our family finances, we've seen, as you said, a massive transfer of economic risk from government and from employers onto individual workers and their families. And I trace this shift back to the early 1970s. We saw a big slowdown in the economy in the 70s. It was a tough period for many workers. We saw stagflation with inflation and a recession at the same time in jobs. And that was sort of the watershed period, if you will. And after the 70s, we see essentially a transformation gradually toward a new economic model in which the idea is that people really should be on the hook for most of the economic risks they face. I think it was put best in some ways last year when Governor Mike Huckabee of Arkansas said that the goal of health savings accounts is to put more skin in the game. So a lot of these changes are about essentially putting more of middle-class workers' skin in the game, making them more responsible for the risks they face. And the result, as we've seen, is that workers are more and more insecure. We're seeing rising levels of bankruptcy and home mortgage foreclosure and skyrocketing levels of personal debt, millions of Americans without health insurance, millions more who don't have adequate insurance. And in short, we've seen a real breakdown of the old idea that being middle class meant being economically secure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting. In the last hour, I wrapped up the hour talking with a fellow about Aaron Russo's new movie, From Freedom to Fascism. And the first half of the movie is basically railing against the income tax. And the point that I make is in Sweden, for example, where the income tax is about 50% on average. Now, if you're a multimillionaire or billionaire, it's much higher. It's much more like the income tax system was here in the United States in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, you know, pre-Reagan. Although the middle class pays a fairly hefty tax. And yet people end up at the end of the day with enough money to live a middle class lifestyle. And the thing that I would say to folks is, and there's this fantasy, this weird fantasy that if we can just get rid of the income tax, we'll have twice as much money. And the fact of the matter is that employers pay what they pay because that's what the market will bear, you know, given or lacking unionization. And if the income tax went away, employers would start paying us half as much. And it's in those societies, because, you know, because that's, you know, what you'd end up with at the end of the day. And in those societies where there is more security, there is greater security, there is, you know, yes, there's higher taxes, but there's also higher wages. How do we help people figure out that this is not about you get to have it or not based on you get to pay taxes or not? How do we break that link in everybody's mind?
Well, I think the first thing that we can point out is that if you count up all of the benefits that are provided by government and corporations, we spend as much as many European nations do on social welfare benefits. And once you look at it that way, you realize that the total spending, including the private sector benefits like employer-provided health insurance and pensions, is about the same as the European average. Then you realize just how bad of a deal we're getting.
Well, and that's because you've got all these giant leeches sucking blood out of the system. You've got the health insurance companies sucking 20% of the...
Health insurance is a perfect example, right? We spend more per person in the United States on health care for people who are covered by Medicare and Medicaid than most countries do spend per person in their countries for health insurance for all citizens.
Right.
And the reason is, of course, that our costs are just so much higher than they are elsewhere. And
because we have a for-profit healthcare system.
And because, and I think even more fundamentally, because we know that a system that's as fragmented as our system just gives everyone an ability and incentive to game the system, to run up huge costs, and it just doesn't allow for the kind of serious conversation about spending and spending control and that you see elsewhere, and it doesn't provide security to the middle class. I mean, the other thing that we see is that, you know, it's not as if those aggregate benefits that are provided by employers, say in pensions, are going equally across the income spectrum. In fact, it's only really Americans at the very top who are getting, who are really doing well under the new, say, 401k retirement system we have now, or who are insured of having good guaranteed health benefits. You know, increasingly middle-class Americans are facing the same strains that we once thought were confined to the working poor. So what we have is a system that costs a lot but doesn't provide security to most Americans. And that's really the message that I think Americans have to hear. They have to understand that it's not as if there isn't ways of doing this better. And I think we've had drummed into our head that globalization and the transformation from manufacturing to services makes it inevitable that we're going to feel so insecure. But that flies in the face of both the real evidence that there are better ways to organize things, and it flies in the face of a simple fact, and that is we have a fairly rich country and economy that has produced strong gains at the top. And it's really not a question of whether we have the money to be able to provide security for all Americans. It's really a question of priorities.
How do you respond to those cons who say, okay, Jacob Hacker, what you're suggesting here is a transfer of wealth? You're talking about taking money away from productive people, people who have been successful by virtue of their own efforts and intellect, and maybe, like Donald Trump, they were born with $1 million. But nonetheless, you're talking about taking money away from those people and giving it to people who just aren't as interested in working as hard.
Well, actually, I'd say that think about who the people at the top, think about corporations. Do they enjoy, do they have to bear all the risks they face? Of course not. We have limited liability for corporations. We have bankruptcy protections for entrepreneurs and investors. And because we have them, people at the, who are trying to start businesses or who are trying to make it financially are willing to take risks.
Well, and a great example is Henry Ford declared bankruptcy 7 times before he finally made it.
And the examples are sort of endless. You know, we actually have good evidence from across countries and from across states that providing a basic level of security is just a key condition for self-employment and for entrepreneurial activity. And this is a mantra among Republicans. We need to help those who take risks. We need to make sure that people who are, you know, contributing to our economic success are being protected from the greatest risks they face. But it seems to be that the assumption is that middle-class Americans and lower-class Americans aren't taking risks, but quite the opposite, they are. And
well, you're taking a risk by living. I mean, right. Alan Greenspan in 1997 told the Wall Street Journal that he felt that an important part of his job as head of the Fed was to keep interest rates high enough, that unemployment was high enough, that a certain minimum threshold was created to maintain, to quoting Alan Greenspan now, a certain minimum level of worker insecurity, end quote. Mm. And that would prevent the workers from organizing and thus representing a potent force against employers.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that there is a bigger story here, which is that most people who have done well in this economy and those who have helped them do well, those political leaders who have helped them do well, just don't see much incentive to changing the system, which has served them so well. And what I'm arguing, though, is that in terms of our economy overall, you know, we build our economy on middle-class security. We build it on the idea that if you could climb into the middle class, that you would be able to have a relatively stable foundation. And when having that pulled out from under Americans, I think, is not just dangerous to middle-class Americans, but it's dangerous to our economy overall.
And it's dangerous to democracy.
I agree.
And we need to remind people that the American dream is not to become Bill Gates. The American dream is to be part of the middle class and have security and safety. Jacob Hacker, the book, The Great Risk Shift. It's marvelous. Check it out. Jacob, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Tom.
GreatRiskShift.com, by the way. 16 minutes past the hour.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be awaiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting. Talk it over. Speak your mind. Decide to do something about it.
There you go. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Yes, bring in the union. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio brought to you by Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, 1-800-425-2532. And where'd my coffee go? What are we drinking here today? Oh, Peruvian French roast. No wonder it's so good. This is the, man, you like a good, strong, dark coffee. It is incredible. Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS. SmallDog.com. And the Organic Wine Company, Eco Wine. 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Well, at the same time that Jacob Hacker documents so brilliantly in his book how risk is being shifted onto the shoulders of Americans, off the shoulders of employers and government, which is the simple prescription, frankly, for serfdom, for creating a feudal state, for creating a vast class of the working poor who are more compliant, more easily managed, and less likely to rise up and rebel and against the established order. And I'm not talking about revolution even. I'm just talking about, remember the 60s and the 70s. You want to get control over people, take away their economic safety and security. At the same time that Jacob Hacker is laying this out, you know, it's amazing. I think back on times in my life when the issue in front of me really was economic safety and security. You know, but having a family, raising three kids, all three of our kids are now in their, two of them are in their 20s, one is in her early 30s. And there have been times when, you know, we had very, very little. And there have been times when we had a lot, relatively speaking. I mean, I've never been fabulously wealthy, but I've done well a few years. Particularly in the early years when Louise and I were first married, you know, there were some times where it was really tight. And when you're living on the edge, when you're living from paycheck to paycheck, or when you don't even have that, when you're living on unemployment, you know, trying to find a job, things like that, the idea of getting out there and getting politically active just isn't front and center. It's not the first thing on your mind. You know, gee, I think I'll go volunteer to be a poll worker, or I think I'll check out the results of the voting machines, or something like that. It just doesn't happen. So if you want to reduce the level of political activity among people in a society, make them poorer. And I truly believe, and not based on conspiracy theory, but on the writings of conservatives themselves, going back 200 years in the United States and England, that a large part, and it's not even an unspoken part, it's an overt part, a large part of the conservative agenda of impoverishing the American middle class has to do with politically disempowering the American middle class. And then the bonus is that if you impoverish the middle class and you are, as Warren Buffett says, you know, he says, there is class warfare in America, my class is winning, and you're part of the winning class, the bonus is you get the middle class's money. And that's certainly what we're seeing. By the way, in the United Kingdom, this in the Times of London, the headline, banks told to predict effects of a 40% crash in housing prices. Banks in the United Kingdom have been ordered by financial regulators to assess how they would cope in the event of housing prices crashing by 40%. This is to assume property prices fall by 40% and that 35% of mortgages are in default, ending with homes being repossessed. In a letter to bank chief executives last month, the FSA accused some of failing to consider scenarios in which they might be forced into losses, dividend cuts, or capital shortfalls. The British are getting ready. Should we be getting ready? At the same time, Henry Paulson, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, Henry Paulson, has a speech scheduled for delivery of the Economic Club of New York today, this from today's Wall Street Journal, will press the case for a reexamination of the government rules and laws he believes are putting U.S. financial markets at a disadvantage amid competition from abroad. Bottom line, he wants further deregulation of our financial markets, more risk on investors, less risk on big corporations. Of course, you know, he used to be the head of Goldman Sachs. Gee, what a surprise. The Republicans just rolling right along here, right over us. 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least a society where it really is one for all and all for one. More people. This is from Wendy Cox's article in the USA Today. The headline, food banks have less to work with, struggle to meet holiday demand. More people are asking for food, even as the amount of government commodities available, milk, cheese, canned goods, and other staples, is down 55%. From 2005. Now, you'll recall on Friday's program, we pointed out that the government is giving $60 million a year to pregnancy crisis centers or pregnancy counseling crisis pregnancy counseling centers, CPCs. These places that pretend that they're abortion clinics, set up shop next door to abortion clinics, advertising the abortion clinics part of the phone book, and then when people walk in, do an ultrasound and say, here's a picture of your baby, aren't you lucky? And, you know, basically freak women out. And, in fact, federal funding for this is increasing. We now have a guy in charge of one of the major parts of Health and Human Services, the part that's responsible for dealing with birth control, who is the former head of a chain of crisis pregnancy centers. So we have hundreds of millions of dollars going to them. Well, government food aid distributed to food banks in 2001 was $418 million. Now, keep in mind, this is $418 million. We're spending $2 billion, $2,000 million a week in Iraq. This is $418 million for the year. And it has been cut down to $201 million for this year. More than cut in half. What is wrong with this picture? I just saw the James Bond movie. Louise and I went to see the James Bond movie, the new Bond movie, over the weekend. It was great. It's a great, you know, it's like good, dumb fun, right? But, and this one, you know, I'm not spoiling the movie for you here. The whole core of the movie, the MacGuffin, you know, to use the movie jargon, as it were, the plot device, is this $115 million that this terrorist is trying to get, this corrupt African leader is transferring to a group that finances terrorists, and James Bond ends up in this poker game, and blah, 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 right? But it's all about $115 million. We have gone missing in Iraq. In $100 bills bundled into plastic bricks, somewhere between $8 and $9 billion. And they devote an entire James Bond movie to $115 million missing dollars. It's like I kept wanting to say to the guy, you know, you don't have to do all this work. All you have to do is become a subcontractor with Halliburton. And $8 billion, that's an amount of physical, we're talking physical dollars. That's an amount of money that it should be visible from outer space. Missing in Iraq. The Pentagon has lost $2 trillion they can't account for. Where to go? Who knows? Carlyle Group seems to be doing well. The Bush compound at Kennebunkport is not wanting for anything. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Paula in Carbondale, Illinois. Hey, Paula, thanks for waiting. What's up?
Well, I was just calling to complain about your reliance or your joy that are shared by so many people that the Democrats have gotten in. And I would like to point out that the Democrats, instead of, and they've already taken off the table investigating 9/11, they've taken off the table.
They have?
Repealing, yeah, Nancy Pelosi, repealing the Patriot Act, the War Commissions Act, or NAFTA. But today I see that Charles Rangel says that he wants to bring back the draft in an effort to stop war.
I agree with him.
I think that's bizarre. He's a House of Representatives, cut off the money if he wants to stop.
Charlie Rangel has been pushing for a draft for 4 years. He's been absolutely consistent on this. I agree with him. You know what stopped the Vietnam War, Paula? Yeah, you know what stopped the Vietnam War? The draft.
So
when people all across America realize
53,000 dead children, you're willing to give up to stop a war. What stopped the war was that the Congress cut off the funds to the Vietnam
War. What stopped the Vietnam War was pressure from the American people, and that pressure was created by the draft.
Okay, I'm not willing to sacrifice my children to some.
Neither am I, and I guarantee you, if there is a draft, the war will end the day after the draft starts.
No,
yeah, it will.
That's deluded. If you want, you know, it's like trying to stop the income tax to stop war. Go for the direct way. Cut off funding. Why would you ruin all those people's lives in some, you know, harebrained scheme to stop a war? That's just
because when you have a draft, then war affects everybody. Right now, war is only affecting the poor, by and large, and the volunteers. But it's disproportionately, our army is drawn from the ranks of the poor. And when war affects the middle class and the wealthy, war stops.
I think that's deluded and twisted.
You can think that, but history is replete with evidences of it, and people, you know.
So from 1965 to 1973, 8 years of a draft until Nixon stopped it, by the way, a Republican, and then the Democrat Carter reinstituted the registration. That's beside the point. The point is, 8 years of kids having their lives ruined, of having 50,000 dead, 100,000 committed suicide afterwards because they couldn't live with it. We got them still on the streets begging for money, and that's all good because
no, that's all wrong. That was all terribly, terribly wrong.
Well, we had a draft.
Do you think that the draft is what created the Vietnam War? Because that's what you're saying.
The draft didn't create the Vietnam War. Of young conscripts, what I would call involuntary servitude, to do to to your children, that made it a lot easier.
I disagree. I think it made it much harder because then the government had to shovel against the tide of public opinion.
Well, a whole lot more died in Vietnam than died in Iraq so far. I'm talking about Americans, of course. Well,
I agree.
Actually, more Vietnamese died than Iraqis have died.
Between
so
2 and 3 million Vietnamese died in
right, and only 600,000 Iraqis so far.
Yeah. I agree with Thomas Jefferson when he said, "I hope we shall never see a day when an American is willing to be shot at for a sixpence." That we essentially have people who are joining the military because they are so desperate because there's no other job opportunity, and I truly believe that we should have a year of national service where people can choose to either join the military or do national service in nonprofit organizations after they graduate from high school as a rite of passage. I've lived in countries and I've worked in countries where that's done, and I think it's a healthy thing. I think it's a healthy transition for teenagers, and I believe, and you look at countries that have drafts, and there are many of them, most of them, in fact, I don't know if it's most, but if you look at countries where you have universal conscription, which is most of the Western European countries, you'll see that those countries don't get involved in wars easily. And the big problem we had during Vietnam was the Texas Air National Guard stuff. If you were well-connected, if you came from money, you could figure out how to get out of going to Vietnam. If you were middle class, you had to, take amphetamines for 5 days in a row, stay up until you were hallucinating, drop acid, and then show up at the draft board. I mean, the weird, bizarre stuff that people went through, and even then it didn't work, and then you get sent off and you get killed. But if you were George W. Bush, you could get out of the draft.
Right. So your theory is if it reinstituted the draft, somehow magically it would apply across the board to everybody. I don't follow that logic at all. I really think you're wrong.
I'm not talking about magic. I'm talking about legislation. I'm saying you reinstitute the draft and you make absolutely universal conscription, yeah.
That's bizarre. Why would you do that? Just cut off the funds to the war. Why be so convoluted?
Well, I'm not opposed to cutting off funds to the war, Paula. I'm totally in favor of that.
You have 20-year-olds, so do I. When they start putting my children at risk, I get upset.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And I believe in this enough that I'm convinced that if we had universal conscription in the United States, the Vietnam War, at least we were sold, we thought that in the Gulf of Tonkin we were under attack, we were living under the whole communist threat, blah de blah de blah. I mean, there were a lot of people who were in favor of that war who believed that there were good reasons for it. I don't think that anybody believes that anymore about Iraq,
The 30% of people who send their children off to war, who breed their children to be cannon fodder, basically, they believe that we were attacked on 9/11.
I think that they're rationalizing.
You can talk to them all you want. Believe me, I talk to them, and they refuse to believe anything different.
Yeah, because you have to rationalize what you're doing.
Well, they always manufacture crises. I mean, that's the history. Goebbels said that. All you have to do is claim you're being attacked, and the farmer will run off to war. That's not going to change because you have a draft.
No, it won't. You're right. And Germany in the last years of the war was drafting everybody. They were drafting 14-year-olds, 13-year-olds. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the reality
is. The war,
that,
did it?
At that point, they were too far into it to stop.
Well,
they would have had to surrender. But the reality is that in those countries where everybody is affected by military action, a country is less likely to take military action.
Well, except for Israel.
I believe that Israel is less likely to take military action. There is a strong peace. There is a strong peace movement in Israel. There is they got a lot of flack. The Olmert government may fall because of what he did in Lebanon. And it is because they have universal conscription, in my opinion.
Well, And I'm glad you're willing to send your child off for a year of involuntary servitude. I'm not willing to do that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Paula. We agree to disagree. Good
okay.
to hear from you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Telling the truth of multinational corporations we'd really rather you didn't know about. We'll continue with your phone calls right after this. 45 minutes past the hour.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good. So good. I got you.
And welcome back to the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, it was Jefferson who argued very strongly, and James Madison as well. In fact, it became the fragment of the discussion became the Second Amendment. Argued that during times of peace, there should not be an army. And during times of war, in their case, at their time, it was every male between the age of 17 and 47. That was the proposal that Jefferson and Madison put forward. Should be part of a national militia, or should be part of a local militia, which could be nationalized. Everybody should have a gun in their home, and when the church bells rang a certain way, they'd grab their gun and step outside, and boom, the whole country is the army. And that's how they do it in Switzerland. And that's one of the reasons many suggest that Switzerland has not been invaded in hundreds of years. So Ellen Ratner's on the line with us in Talk Radio News in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, I just had a discussion with one of our callers. I am supporting Charlie Rangel's call for a draft. What's your...
Well, I actually wrote an article for WorldNet Daily about 3 or 4 years ago that supported the draft, and I have long been in favor of the draft. It's interesting today, Nancy Pelosi, when asked about this, had sort of she basically said, well, Mr. Rangel has long held this position, and it's not about the draft, it's about shared sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said, Mr. Rangel will be very busy with his work on the Ways and Means Committee, whose jurisdiction is quite a different jurisdiction. Then Steny Hoyer said, well, the Speaker and I have been discussing scheduling of top Democratic items, and it does not include the draft.
Yeah, so don't plan on a draft. But nonetheless, we can discuss it. Let's take a few calls here. Reed in San Francisco, California, you're live with Ellen Ratner and me. Hey.
Oh, hey, I just wanted to call. It's interesting you bring this up. My wife and I, who don't have kids, but we have great nephews, we were discussing the draft a couple of nights ago, and we're completely against the war, and we protested it, but we also agreed that if there was a draft, one of our full-time jobs would be doing nothing but making sure that we were protesting the war and keeping our nephews and our niece out of fighting.
There you go.
I completely agree. The only thing that is going to stop these sort of wars is if everybody across the board is threatened has the potential to be drafted.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the bottom line. I mean, the draft with Vietnam, the draft came along after the war was already, underway. And probably starting a draft when a war is already underway is not going to necessarily stop the war, although it's going to massively increase the pressure. But if you had national conscription before the war was declared, there would have been a whole lot of senators and a whole lot of members of Congress who would have been a whole lot less enthusiastic to vote to give George Bush the power to go into a war.
And as an alternative to the draft, how about this? How about any member of Congress or Senate who votes to support a war, immediately their children and their nieces and nephews have to be conscripted to go for it?
Well, why not just send them?
Yeah, well,
I mean, you vote for a war, you get to be part of the ready reserve. You're now a second lieutenant in the army,
well,
buddy. Here's
part of the reason that it's never going to pass to Congress is because they're aware once it passes, then their kids are going to be right there.
There you go, Reed. Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, good point, Ellen. Very well said. 1-866-440-8466. KJ in Camas, Washington.
Tom. The rich in this country seem to have already abdicated all their responsibilities toward our society. What makes you think that they will not find a way to wiggle out of a draft?
Well, you just absolutely write the law that way. I mean, it's just that simple. You'd have to make it bulletproof. Otherwise, why do it? All right. Right, Ellen?
Exactly.
Okay. Andy in Monterey, California. Hey, Andy. Listening on KRXA.
Hey, Tom, how are you? Sorry, Colin talked about Paul's point a couple of minutes ago. You know, if Charlie Rangel's proposition had come up and even discussion a couple of years ago, we wouldn't even be in this war to begin with, because I guarantee it would have put a left of sour mouth in everybody in America's mouth. There would have been a little bit of an uprising, a lot more than the people that are uprising right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we wouldn't even be having a discussion at all. You know,
see, I think if we'd had a draft, if we had continued the draft after World War II, and people were being drafted at the time that we went into Vietnam, we wouldn't have gone into Vietnam in the first place. And if we'd had a draft at the time that the vote was held with George, to give George W. Bush the authority, he wouldn't have gotten the authority.
Oh, I think, Tom, you are 100% correct. Not a chance in America.
Yeah, interesting.
Or anywhere else.
Mark and Eureka, by the way, if you have questions for Ellen, by the way, hang on just a second, Mark. Ellen, anything happening in Washington, D.C. we need to know about?
Yeah, I mean, the main issues, obviously, are the Rangel draft issue, and there's one other issue that I think you should know about, which apparently word has it that the CIA is on a fast track towards increasing their agency by 50% by the year 2011.
Well, they certainly have a good PR flick out, you know, this new movie with Matt Damon in it. It's, we saw the promos for it yesterday. Anyhow, Mark in Eureka, California, you're live with Ellen and me. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, I'm a conservative, and I feel the greatest threat to the sovereignty of this nation right now are defense contractors and their corrupt politicians. So I would never support a forced conscription for setting up our kids for cannon fodder. So, Tom, I think you just exposed yourself as a neoliberal, my friend.
Why forced conscription? Why
a neoliberal? That's a new one, Tom.
Well, a neoliberal is a European term, actually. It's
neoconservative. Okay.
A neoconservative, I'm sorry.
You meant neoconservative, yeah, okay. Yep. Well, you know, why?
What's liberal about forced conscription, Tom? What's liberal about that?
I don't think it's a matter of liberal or conservative. I think it's a matter of what's best for America.
And so it's good to set up kids for defense contractor cannon fodder?
No, I would never do that. And I think that if all of our kids, if everybody had to serve a year of public service after they got out of high school, then you would not have cannon fodder, because we the people wouldn't allow it. Ellen Ratner, thanks for joining us, Ellen.
You got it.
Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. We'll be back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So who should be serving? See, I see this as a good thing for a whole bunch of reasons, this idea of national service, mandatory national service. First of all, the caller at the end of the last hour, he said, you know, you've exposed yourself as a neocon, because I've come out in favor of a draft. Actually, you know, it's interesting. If you think of the difference between the liberal worldview of Washington and Jefferson and the founders of this country and all the way up to George McGovern and all the way up to today, the real liberals and progressives, the foundation of that worldview, as opposed to the traditional conservative worldview as expressed in the founding of this country by Alexander Hamilton and John Adams and Sir Edmund Burke, all the way up to today with Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, Richard Pearl, Bill Kristol. The fundamental difference, and you can break pretty much every topic down to this, the fundamental difference between the conservative and the liberal worldview is that the conservative worldview holds the vision of Davy Crockett the highest. The lone guy with the coonskin cap who goes off into the wilderness and all by himself creates something. Which is a nice myth, but it's a myth. And the liberals hold the traditional ideal of community up as their myth, that we are a nation of barn builders, that we all get together and build the neighbor's barn because it burned down or because they need a new barn. That the conservative would say that the thing that defines the quality and nature of a society, the thing that tells you if a society is being successful, is whether or not there are individuals or institutions that represent great wealth and power. And a liberal would tell you that the thing that defines the quality of a society, the thing that defines whether or not a society is successful, the measurable, quantifiable thing in a society, is the extent to which all persons in the society feel the safety and security that those wealthy individuals do in the conservative society. You know, Abraham Maslow, back in the 1970s, came up with this hierarchy of human needs. And in his hierarchy of human needs, it starts out with homeostasis. That's the first thing we need. We need to keep our body going. You need to eat, to drink, to pee, to breathe, to regulate your body temperature. Just, you know, the basic stuff. Then once that need is taken care of, and believe me, those needs are pretty aggressive. Somebody comes along and covers up your mouth and nose so you can't breathe, you'll know about the homeostatic needs real fast, right? That's how waterboarding works. That's how torture works. It violates homeostasis. Once the homeostatic needs are met, then the needs for safety are met. People try to get their safety needs met. Do I have a roof over my head? Am I safe? Once that is met, then the need for security comes along. Now, these are all basically visceral needs. The homeostatic needs operate functionally below the level of logic. They're something we share with frogs. The needs for safety and security operate below the level of logic. They operate at the level, arguably at the level of emotion, but reptiles that don't have a limbic brain like we do, like most mammals do, where emotion is experienced, also experience those fundamental needs. Once those needs are met, then we go to the social needs, the low social needs, the need for community, family, tribe, clan, village. Once that need is met, then the higher social needs, the need for friendship, relationship, interconnectedness on an individual level, the need to fall in love. And once that need is met, then people go to the highest human needs, the needs for self-actualization. For that, you know, that moment of standing on the edge of the rim of the Grand Canyon, looking out and going, wow. You know, and some people would say, isn't it extraordinary? And other people would say, there is a God, or, you know, whatever. It's just that moment of, oh, wow. But somebody who is starving is not thinking about the, oh, wow, or about falling in love, or about being part of their family, or even about whether or not there's a roof over their house. They're thinking about food. So the conservative worldview says, okay, those basic needs, the basic homeostatic needs, in other words, the need to be hungry, to not be hungry, forget it. It's not society's job to fulfill that. And the need for safety and security, that isn't society's needs. Give somebody a coonskin cap, or you don't even give it to them. Let them pull themselves up by their own coonskin cap. And liberals say, no, we as a society measure the quality of our life and the quality of our society by what happens to the least among us, not the richest among us. And here we have $201 million spent this year for government aid to food banks, down from $400 million in 2001, the year that Bush came into office. So, again, is the draft a liberal idea or a conservative idea? The draft comes out of the idea that we're all in this together. We're going to share the sacrifice. If we collectively, through our elected representatives, are going to decide that we're going to go to war, either offensively or defensively, if we decide that we're going to go to war, then we're going to collectively share that burden. And so I would say that the draft is the ultimate liberal idea. It brings the country together. It puts us all in the same boat. See, the foundational liberal idea is we're all in the same boat. That a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And therefore, you have to pay attention to the weak links. Whereas the conservatives would say, well, no, the quality of the chain is the biggest and strongest links among it. And they're wrong. It's just that simple. That's why whenever you have the conservative worldview ascendant in the United States, and we keep going through these cycles back and forth, we had the liberal worldview ascendant from the time of the American Revolution until the 1830s. Then the conservative worldview took over, and that led us into the Civil War. And then the liberal worldview took over, and that led us to Reconstruction of the 1880s. And then the conservative worldview took over, and that brought us to the robber barons. And then the backlash of that was the liberal worldview, or the progressive worldview, the populists and the progressives, started in the 1880s, and by 1901, they took power with Teddy Roosevelt, oddly enough, a Republican president. And from 1901 to 1921, arguably, the liberal worldview ruled. And then the conservatives took over again, and the corporations again exploded. More huge fortunes were made between 1921 and 1929. And then the great crash revealed it again for the corrupt, bankrupt philosophy that it is. And the Republican Great Depression of 1929-1930 led to a flip again, and the liberal worldview arose and pretty much dominated America until the 1980s, when Reagan came in with the Reagan Revolution and the conservative worldview took over. And for 26 years, we've been living under the conservative worldview. So to bring this back to the draft, again, I would say that that having a year of national service... You say, are you in favor of mandatory conscription? Well, mandatory taxes? There is a price that you pay for being a member of a society. It's really that simple. And if that society is going to engage in war, participating in those wars is part of the price you pay. Particularly if it's a democracy and you have a say in whether that society is going to have that war. And as long as America is a democracy, and as long as we all are involved in it, you know, I think we'll start making the right decisions. 15 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be back with your calls right after this. And welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. I get a note here from Tim. He says, I'm a Vietnam vet and take exception to what you said. If you check your facts, the military draft was in effect from 48 to 73. You're right. Thus, your assertion that the military draft was not in effect when the Vietnam War was ramped up after the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 64, August of 64, was incorrect. The draft was a totally accepted part of the American scene until a whole lot of guys started getting killed in Nam. The anti-war movement didn't really gain a great deal of momentum in the mass populace until the late 60s, and the war had been going on for some time until then. Interesting. Well, you know, I was alive back then. I remember it well. But my memory may well have been colored by the fact that I was of draft age at the time. John in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, John, you've got some information on this?
Yeah, basically, I pulled up a Wikipedia article, Selective Service and Training Act, came in 1940, and then it ended in 1973.
Right.
So.
But actually never ended. We just stopped drafting people because the draft is still there. You have to register for it when you turn 18 or whatever the age is now.
18 through 25 are required to register.
Right.
Service system.
Yeah.
So, just so that's clear. Also, I'm the one who left you a message last Friday offering the copy of Freedom to Fascism, so I'm happy that you took the time to view it. I may be providing additional thoughts on your forum. especially with respect to the relationship with the Federal Reserve System.
Great. Yeah, I'm not a fan of the Fed. I'm relatively agnostic on that. I mean, I'm with Aaron Russo that the Fed, or not so much with him, but with some of the folks there, that the Fed, you know, is basically the bankers own the world. Yeah, sure, absolutely. But doing away with the income tax, all this stuff gets all conflated. Doing away with the income tax, in my opinion, is not the solution to the problem. Doing away with the Fed might be, but then you end up with the problem where you have the government minting the money that the government spends, and you end up with Weimar Germany, you know, with the 70% inflation rate or 100% inflation rate, you know, weekly.
Yeah.
And although we may be there, we may be going there now anyway, because the Fed has become, so politicized since Greenspan. So I don't know, John. But that's a discussion for another time.
Complex issue. Let's talk about it.
And another time, because right now I got a bunch of people who want to talk about the draft. So John, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Ian in San Francisco. Hey, Ian.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to say I support your idea on the draft. But I wanted to offer another alternative as well, and one that maybe Charlie Rangel could take up in his new role. And that is that if you take the idea would be that we would pay for the war now. Now, we won't have to send our boys if we didn't have a draft, but or our daughters, but we would have to pay for it now. And this also fits, by the way, the Democrats' idea of pay as you go. Which
you're talking about everybody in America having to cough up around $10,000, $12,000 immediately.
Well, here's what it comes out to. I did the math, and you tell me if I got it wrong. You were saying it's about $2 billion a week. I think that's conservative.
Well, right now what's been appropriated is $500 billion. So you start out with $500 billion and you divide that by 115 million working families, and that's your cost per wager.
I'm just saying let's just start paying now, and let's just do the math on that. $2 billion a week.
Yeah.
That comes to $104 billion a year. Let's say it's $90 billion, just to make the numbers easy.
Yeah.
Because we just found out we have 300 million people.
Right.
Okay? So if you take 90 billion and divide it by 300 million, you come out to $300 a year for each man, woman, and child.
Right.
For a family of four, that's $1,200.
Right.
Per year. And then this would be you pay this in addition to any other tax you pay. We're going to pay for it now. Pay
it's
as
a war tax.
Yeah. Okay, if you did that, I'm telling you, I've talked to people. They say they support the war. I said, okay. You know, you think
where's your $1,200?
Yeah, well, I say, you know, would you be willing to pay for it now? I said, if you did, how many people do you have in your family? Well, you have four. Okay, well, would you be willing to pay $1,200 a year? I mean, above and beyond, and this is actual money being paid, so we pay for it now in order to pay for that war. Well, no, we don't really need to do that.
Right.
I said, well, wait a minute. So you're saying that you're willing to send a somebody else's child to go fight and die for this war you say you believe in, and you also say you support the troops, but you're not willing to even pay for it. Stay home. You're not going into any war. You're going to stay home, and you're not even willing to pay for it. If the Democrats put that one on the table, and if it was to pass, and Charlie Rangel, is he on the Ways and Means, or is he budget? What is he?
I don't know.
I think he's Ways and Means. I may be wrong. But if he's Ways and Means, that means he's on taxation.
Yep.
And if he was to put that one on the table, that would be within his jurisdiction.
There you go.
And he put that on the table and passed that sucker, I'm telling you, this war would be over tonight.
Things would change. Yeah, if it's either our kids or our dollars that are at risk, then things change.
Over.
Yeah, well said, Ian. Thanks a lot for the call. Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Janice.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I agree that had there been a draft before this war, we wouldn't have had the war. But it's like a time issue. We can't do it now because it's not going to stop them. And my biggest concern is the fact that, you know, we still have the same people, the same players committing the war crimes. They weren't taken to task the first time.
See, I think all that's going to change, Janice. I may be wrong. I hope not. And you know, I'm not always right, but usually on these things, you know, it seems that I am. I really think that this is changing. The public sentiment has turned so completely against the occupation. I don't call it a war in Iraq. It's an occupation.
It's right.
Against the occupation of Iraq. I mean, we had a successful war, and everybody thought it was just wonderful. You know, George W. Bush getting up there on the aircraft carrier and telling everybody that, you know.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq,
the United States and our allies have prevailed.
And everybody said, yeah, great. And in fact, the war was over. And the occupation began, and we've just had this totally screwed up occupation, you know. But Janice, thanks for the call. We've got to take a break here. 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. 366. Oh, interesting. I was trying to remember what the top number was in the draft lottery. And Or Capel in our chat room says it was 366. So here's my proposal for the new draft lottery. We'll do a lottery from 0 to 3. They use the number of days in the year. 0 to 365. And you rent numbers are randomly pulled, but they're pulled from two separate pools. People who are registered as Republicans, the lower the number, the more you immediately get drafted. If you're a registered Republican, your number is going to be, you're going to be pulled out of the pool from zero, from 1 to 170. And if you're an independent or a Democrat or a Green, then you get pulled from 171 to 365. Makes sense, right? I don't know. Let's check in and see how things are going with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
Security developments in Iraq as of 0620 Greenwich Mean Time on Monday. This is from Reuters. Dateline Fallujah. U.S. Marine died on Sunday from wounds suffered in combat in the western province of Anbar. In Baghdad, Iraqi special forces backed by U.S. advisors raided a group suspected of kidnapping, torturing, and murdering Iraqi civilians and soldiers, the U.S. military said. The raid was in Sadr City, the Shiite militia stronghold in Baghdad. U.S. statements that Iraqi forces searched a mosque. No one was detained, and there was minimal damage to the mosque. Near Baghdad, the bodies of 14 people with gunshot wounds and bearing signs of torture were found dumped south of Baghdad. In Ramadi, U.S. forces conducted an airstrike and killed two suspected insurgents on Sunday in that Sunni stronghold. Stronghold? It's a Sunni town. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb exploded near a police patrol and wounded two civilians near a highway in central Baghdad. In Baqaba, gunmen killed a police officer from the Facility Protection Services, FSP, along with his driver in the religiously mixed city of Baqaba, 65 kilometers, 40 miles north of Baghdad, police said. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Guy in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Guy, what's on your mind today? Guy?
Oh,
hey, sorry about that. It's your turn, Guy. What's
up? Hey, thanks for letting me on, Tom. You know, the thing the draft does is it makes everybody responsible for the decisions that are made in this country.
Right. That's my point. That's the liberal idea, that we're all in this together.
I was at an anti-war demonstration a couple months back, and we were surrounded by these people with signs saying, you know, we support the troops and all this stuff. And I walked over to these people who were, you know, supposedly supporting the troops and for the war, and I asked them two things. And one of them was, shouldn't there be a limit on how many times soldiers are sent over to Iraq? And, you know, I'm surrounded by about 15, 20 people, and not one person thought there should be any limits. The other is, what do you think about a draft? I mean, you know, this is a war for the country. Shouldn't all Americans be, shouldn't all Americans participate? And again, none of these people, these conservatives who are supposedly, you know, all for our troops, none of them thought there should be a draft.
Yeah, yeah. Surprise, surprise.
And that's the problem with this administration is they don't want to take responsibility for their decisions.
And it comes from, you know, a fish rots from the head down. It's George W. Bush never took responsibility for anything in his life, And frankly, I think that that's sort of the Republican way these days is, you know, you come into the world with inherited wealth. It's like Donald Trump. You know, his father was a multimillionaire real estate mogul, and he gives Donald his first fortune. Donald loses a good chunk of it, actually. And then he tries to portray himself as a self-made man. I mean, give me a break. It's And these guys are like, yeah, this is we'll run the country, right? Yeah, give me a break.
Well, they play poor boy. It's like, how many times have you seen George Bush cut shrubs and you know, on the farm, you know, down in Texas?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you notice, he's never dirty. I mean, I don't know how he does it. You know, when I pull out a chainsaw, I get dirty. I get oil on me, you know, all this stuff. Yeah. He is perfectly clean. His hair is perfect. And he doesn't even get sawdust on him. I mean, it's called
a photo op. Guy, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Bear with me a second. But along the lines of the draft with Charlie Rangel, this is a really rough idea. But I'd like to see some kind of limitation on profits by the military-industrial complex during times of war. Let them help share in the sacrifice.
Oh, yeah. What's called a windfall profits tax.
You know, just limit it down to 1% or maybe even a contribution in the form of a small loss.
Yeah.
And that would put an end to this stuff real fast.
Well, you know, during World War II, Harry Truman, and World War II, by the way, did not last as long as we have now been in Iraq. Okay, so they had an incentive to get done with World War II really fast. They had the pressure of a draft. They had Americans sacrificing. And so Roosevelt and Truman absolutely did everything humanly possible to end World War II quickly. And we have been in Iraq now longer than we were in World War II. And during World War II, Harry Truman, as the senator from Missouri, the Democratic senator from Missouri, took on the president, took on Franklin Roosevelt, and said, I'm going to investigate whether there's war profiteering going on within the Roosevelt administration. And within, you know, if there's any cronies or friends going on. And what did Franklin Roosevelt say? He said, fine, do it. And together they put people in prison. They put people in jail. Prescott Bush lost one of his banks as a consequence of those investigations because he was doing business with Hitler. I mean, yeah, it's time to bring back the war profiteering investigations. Well said, Dave. Thank you very much. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, first of all, that Aaron Russo movie, did you see that in a theater or DVD? Or?
No, I watched it on my PC.
Okay, yeah.
I saw the whole thing. I saw the DVD.
Yeah, you know, it is available on pay-per-view. Yeah, I understand why it's tempting, you know, to want to go ahead and throw this draft issue at the Republicans.
Well, it's not the only solution. It's a piece of a larger comprehensive thing, mm-hmm. and that is coming back to the idea that we collectively as Americans are going to take responsibility for America.
Well, yeah, but you got all these conspiracy theories out there about Bush having Paul Wellstone killed and September 11th and all this stuff. To me, this kind of you're taking a chance on giving Bush keys to a Lamborghini. Iraq here. I think
again, your assumption, Joe, is that if Bush has access to a lot of cannon fodder by virtue of a draft, mm-hmm. that somehow that's going to work to his benefit. And I disagree. I think it brought down Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson's own party would not renominate him for president because he was unable to end the Vietnam War. And then Richard Nixon campaigned in the election of 68. He campaigned on the platform that he had a secret plan to end the war, that he was going to end the war. It wasn't the secret plan campaign. It was that he had a plan to end the war. He didn't end the war. In 72, he said he had a secret plan to end the war. And by the time that he, I would argue that the impeachment proceedings against him in large part came about, or not in large part, but in substantial part, came about as a consequence of the widespread discontent with Nixon's, the fact that he didn't have a secret plan. He didn't get us out of the war. You mm-hmm. can't maintain an unpopular war when the people of, when everybody in the country is sacrificing. During World War II, it was a relatively popular war. People got it. We were fighting for something.
Well, I want to get to that because I think this thing in Iraq is going to be winding down, and I think they're going to come up with something for Iran, and that guy in Iran is a perfectly made villain for the
sure.
Bush administration.
Yeah, and so you think there's going to be a false flag operation of some kind? It wouldn't surprise me, Joe. It wouldn't surprise me. And you know, all the more the tragedy, and thus all the more the reason that we all have to be attentive and conscious. And frankly, again, I think if there was a draft, the average American would be paying much more careful attention to international relations. Frankly, I don't think the average American even absorbs more than a minute or two a day of international news. I mean, literally, a minute or two a day of international news.
But at the very least, can Charles Rangel and some of these other guys come up with something where the selective service system isn't so sexist? You know, where it's just, you know, where it's just men from 18 to 26 that go into it. At
sure.
the very least, can we put that on?
Make it universal and draft Jenna and Barbara first. Glenda in Mill Creek. Thank you, Joe. Glenda in Mill Creek, Washington. Hey, Glenda. We have about a half a minute here.
Oh, I know. It's really quick, Tom. I just had to laugh over your idea on the draft rankings of Republicans 0 to 170 and then Democrats 171 in honor.
Yeah.
Hearing all that. Well, I think we should just carry it just a little bit far to add a little bit more humor, is that anyone who's wealthy and Republican should be 0 to 50.
Ah, yes. Okay. And if you own stock in a defense contracting company, then you're 0 to 10.
Exactly. We could really carry this on. So anyway, it was just fun listening to that this morning, and I love you.
Thank you. Thank you, Glenda. Okay. I appreciate the call. It's very sweet of you. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls after this. It's the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stick around.
I don't want millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
Always a good plan. Welcome back. Thank you, Tom Rush.
I don't want.
Tom Rush, by the way, he was always one of my favorite musicians. I used to just love his music. And back in the late 70s, 78, Louise and I started this community for abused kids in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Village. And must have been about 1979, 1980. Tom lived in New Hampshire, in Hillsborough, New Hampshire. And we let him know about what we were up to, and he was on our advisory board, and he came over and he did a benefit for us. And when we had our 10th anniversary, which would have been 1988 or 89, he showed up and he played for everybody. It was just, he's such a good guy and such a brilliant musician. So it's unlikely that he's listening, but if you are, Tom Rush, it's been a lot of years since we've talked, and I still love your music and hope life is well. Because we all kind of moved on from there. He moved out to Colorado, and we moved down to Atlanta. And anyhow, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And John in San Francisco, California on the line. Hey, John.
Yeah, Tom, I think this exemplifies this statement and position of Charlie Rangel, why at this point the Democrats are even more dangerous than the Republicans. I think that it's really at the very point that Bush has, and all the experts say Bush is running out of cannon fodder. He's burned them up with these recyclings.
Running out of cannon fodder. He's running out of public support.
He's running out of both. He's running out of both, and here.
No, because if he had a lot of public support, he would have plenty of cannon fodder. There was no, there would be no shortage of people volunteering for the army. Look at all the people who volunteered right after 9/11. The Pat Tillmans of the world.
Yeah, the point I'm making is I think that the Democrats are now going to be shilling for this war and further wars like against Iraq, Iran, and North Korea.
Well, I hope you're wrong,
John. This is the justification. This is the rationale that Charlie Rangel is using. At the very point that they don't have the public support, they don't have the troops, here comes Charlie Rangel wildly riding to the rescue.
Charlie Rangel has been calling for a draft since we invaded Iraq.
But he is doing it on the justification that we won't have enough troops to saber-rattle or attack Iran, North Korea.
No, he's been doing it. He's been doing it on
these people.
No, Charlie Rangel.
John,
you're misrepresenting Charlie Rangel. I mean, go back and look at his statements on this.
Charlie
Rangel has been saying from day one that a military should not be made up of basically the poor.
The point is that we're going to have the worst of both. We would have exactly the kind of cannon fodder Bush at this point desperately needs to attack Iran, North Korea, and other countries that Bush, that Charlie Rangel is himself citing as the rationale for it, and we would have the involuntary servitude of this alternative service, which would be unpaid labor to bust unions and depress wages in this country. It is absolutely treacherous that the Democrats and those on Air America and the rest of it will now become shilling for the very means to drag us into the dreams of these neocons for world domination.
Well,
and I think it shows there's no difference.
John, I'm right there with you in that the neocons have dreams for world domination. And
well, the point is,
I got it. No, you're not. You haven't heard my point yet, John. My point is that Bush, as I said, and I just consider this for a minute. Bush is not running out of cannon fodder. He's running out of public support.
Both.
When Pat Tillman joined the Army right after 9/11,
exactly.
He was part of a wave of people who joined the Army after 9/11. There was a huge
need a draft to have people turn against this war. It's gone now. And here comes Charlie Rangel. This guy is also head of Ways and Means, which you didn't realize. He's called for absolutely allowing these total giveaways to the richest 1%. The Democrats are doing the dirty work of the Republicans at this point. I think the ruling class turning to the Republicans to do the work because they can.
Thank you very much, John. John, if you're right, if the Democrats are doing the work of the ruling class and carrying water for the wealthy in the United States, it's all the more reason for you and I to get involved in the Democratic Party and take it back. Because we have a two-party system in the United States, and the Republican Party is totally lost. They're totally gone. They're over the edge. They're irredeemable at this point. And the Democratic Party, at least I think is, at least as long as Howard Dean is running it, I think it has some potential. Dave in St. Paul, Nebraska. Hey, Dave, you want to take us back to our conversation 2 hours ago about polling, voting machines and whatnot?
And guess what? You got me instead of Dave because Dave had to go take care of the chickens.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay,
your name is?
What I wanted to tell you is we do have recounts in Nebraska.
You do?
Our county just had a recount. Our county assessor's election ended at 12:48 and 12:58, and that's a state-mandated recount.
Okay, but I misspoke. If the article that I wrote back 3 years ago about Chuck Hagel,
yeah,
indicated that what I learned in doing the research was that when he was elected, which was what, 12 years ago, 10 years ago, 10 years ago, I think it was, when Chuck Hagel was elected and the people in Nebraska didn't realize that he was the president of ES&S and that they were voting on ES&S machines, that the legislature immediately after his election passed a law saying that the contents of the voting machines could not be examined, that the ballots could not be examined. I guess that wouldn't rule out a recount. But it would mean that the software, that the proprietary nature of the software and the databases was to be protected.
Yeah, that is probably right, but we do have recounts. Yeah.
Okay, all righty. How do you recount a chip?
Okay, we just went to machines, and ours are paper ballots that they put into a machine and they count.
Oh, okay, so you did the hand recounts?
No, they actually, they put them in the machine and recounted.
Fed them through the same machine? Yeah.
Yep. Hmm. Yep.
A possible problem.
You're right. I'm for a paper trail all the way, but we do have recounts.
Yeah, good point.
And you can pay for a recount, too, if you want.
Yeah. Oh, good. Thank you for setting me straight. And I never did get your name.
I'm Nina.
Nina, thank you very much. Great to hear from you. Oh, my. And I noticed Paul in San Jose, California on the line. And I'm sorry, Paul, we're out of time to take the call, but you say we should have a draft for Iraqis. That's a good point. You know, if we were to start, if there was a broad draft of Iraqis and you were throwing them all together, you might be able to put that country back together again. Although, frankly, I think it's way past the point where that's going to happen. We'll continue tomorrow. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
And remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.